"Hurry up," Paul said. "I want to collapse the tent." A shower of sand from the surface brushed her left hand. "How much sand will the hand hold?" she asked herself. "Shall I help you?" Paul asked. "No." She swallowed in a dry throat, slipped into the hole, felt static, packed sand rasp under her hands. Paul reached down, took her arm. She stood beside him on a smooth patch of starlit desert, stared around. Sand almost brimmed their basin, leaving only a dim lip of surrounding rock. She probed the farther darkness with her trained senses. Noise of small animals. Birds. A fall of dislodged sand and faint creature sounds within it. Paul collapsing their tent, recovering it up the hole. Starlight displaced just enough of the night to charge each shadow with menace. She looked at patches of blackness. "Black is blind remembering," she thought. "You listen for pack sounds, for the cries of those who hunted your ancestors in a past so ancient only your most primitive selves remember. The ears see. The nostrils see." Presently Paul stood beside her, said, "Duncan told me that if he was captured, he could hold out this long. We must leave here now." He shouldered the pack, crossed to the shallow lip of the basin, climbed to a ledge that looked down on open desert. Jessica followed automatically, noting how she now lived in her son's orbit. "For now is my grief heavier than the sands of the seas," she thought. "This world has emptied me of all but the oldest purpose. Tomorrow's life. I live now for my young Duke, and the daughter yet to be." She felt the sand drag her feet as she climbed to Paul's side. He looked north across a line of rocks, studying a distant escarpment. The faraway rock profile was like an ancient battleship of the seas outlined by stars. The long swish of it lifted on an invisible wave with syllables of boomerang antennae, funnels arching back, a pie-shaped upthrusting at the stern. An orange glare burst above the silhouette and a line of brilliant purple cut downward toward the glare. Another line of purple, and another upthrusting orange glare. It was like an ancient naval battle, remembered shellfire, and the sight held them staring. "Pillars of fire," Paul whispered. A ring of red eyes lifted over the distant rock. Lines of purple laced the sky.
"Jet flares and laser guns," Jessica said.
The dust-reddened first moon of Arrakis lifted above the horizon to their left, and they saw a storm trail there, a ribbon of movement over the desert. "It must be Harkon and Thopters hunting us," Paul said, "the way they're cutting up the desert. It's as though they were making certain they stamped out whatever's there. The way you'd stamp out a nest of insects."
"Or a nest of Atreides," Jessica said.
"We must seek cover," Paul said. "We'll head south and keep to the rocks. If they caught us in the open..." He turned, adjusting the pack to his shoulders. "They're killing anything that moves." He took one step along the ledge and, in that instant, heard the low hiss of gliding aircraft, saw the dark shapes of ornithopters above them.
My father once told me that respect for the truth comes close to being the basis for all morality. "Something cannot emerge from nothing," he said. This is profound thinking if you understand how unstable the truth can be. From Conversations with Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
"I've always prided myself on seeing things the way they truly are. That's the curse of being a Mentat. You can't stop analyzing your data."
The leathered old face of Thufir Hawat appeared composed in the pre-dawn dimness as he spoke. His sappho-stained lips were drawn into a straight line, with radial creases spreading upward. A robed man squatted silently on sand across from Hawat, apparently unmoved by the words. The two crouched beneath a rock overhang that looked down on a wide, shallow sink. Dawn was spreading over the shattered outline of cliffs across the basin, touching everything with pink. It was cold under the overhang, a dry and penetrating chill left over from the night. There had been a warm wind just before dawn, but now it was cold. Howard could hear teeth chattering behind him among the few troopers remaining in his force. The man squatting across from Howard was a Fremen who had come across the sink in the first light of false dawn, skittering over the sand, blending into the dunes, his movements barely discernible. The Fremen extended a finger to the sand between them, drew a figure there. It looked like a bowl with an arrow spilling out of it.
There are many Harkonnen patrols.
He lifted his finger, pointed upward across the cliffs that Howard and his men had descended. Howard nodded. Many patrols, yes. But still he did not know what this Fremen wanted, and this rankled. Mentat training was supposed to give a man the power to see motives. This had been the worst night of Howard's life. He had been at Simpo, a garrison village, buffer outpost for the former capital city Carthag, when the reports of attack began arriving. At first he thought, it's a raid. The Harkonnens are testing. But report followed report. Faster and faster. 2 legions landed at Carthag. 5 legions, 50 brigades, attacking the Duke's main base at Arakeen. A legion at Arsunt. 2 battle groups at Splintered Rock. Then the reports became more detailed. There were Imperial Sardauka among the attackers, possibly 2 legions of them. And it became clear that the invaders knew precisely which weight of arms to send where. Precisely. Superb intelligence. Howard's shocked fury had mounted until it threatened the smooth functioning of his Mentat capabilities. The size of the attack struck his mind like a physical blow. Now, hiding beneath a bit of desert rock, he nodded to himself, pulled his torn and slashed tunic around him as though warding off the cold shadows. The size of the attack. He had always expected their enemy to hire an occasional lighter from the guild for probing raids. That was an ordinary enough gambit in this kind of house-to-house warfare. Lighters landed and took off on Arrakis regularly to transport the spice for House Atreides. Howard had taken precautions against random raids by false spice lighters. For a full attack, they'd expected no more than 10 brigades. But there were more than 2,000 ships down on Arrakis at the last count. Not just lighters, but frigates, scouts, monitors, crushers, troop carriers, dump boxes. More than 100 brigades. 10 legions. The entire spice income of Arrakis for 50 years... might just cover the cost of such a venture. It might. I underestimated what the Baron was willing to spend in attacking us, Howard thought. I failed my Duke. Then there was the matter of the traitor. I will live long enough to see her strangled, he thought. I should have killed that Bene Gesserit witch when I had the chance. There was no doubt in his mind who had betrayed them. The Lady Jessica. She fitted all the facts available.
Your man Gurney Halleck and part of his force are safe with our smuggler friends.
Good.
So Gurney will get off this hell planet. We're not all gone. Howard glanced back at the huddle of his men. They had started the night just past with 300 of his finest. Of those, an even 20 remained, and half of them were wounded. Some of them slept now, standing up, leaning against the rock, sprawled on the sand beneath the rock. Their last thopter, the one they'd been using as a ground effect machine to carry their wounded, had given out just before dawn. They had cut it up with laser guns and hidden the pieces, then worked their way down into this hiding place at the edge of the basin. Howard had only a rough idea of their location, some 200 kilometers southeast of Arakeen. The main travelled ways between the Shield Wall CH communities were somewhere south of them. The Fremen across from Howard threw back his hood and stillsuit cap to reveal sandy hair and beard. The hair was combed straight back from a high, thin forehead. He had the unreadable total blue eyes of the spice diet. Beard and moustache were stained at one side of the mouth, his hair matted there by pressure of the looping catch tube from his nose plugs. The man removed his plugs, readjusted them. He rubbed at a scar beside his nose.
If you cross the sink here this night, you must not use shields. There is a break in the wall.
He turned on his heels, pointed south.
There. And it is open sand down to the erg. Shields will attract it. Worm. They don't often come in here, but a shield will bring one every time.
He said worm, Howard thought. He was going to say something else. What? And what does he want of us? Howard sighed. He could not recall ever before being this tired. It was a muscle weariness that energy pills were unable to ease. Those damnable Sardaukar! With a self-accusing bitterness, he faced the thought of the soldier fanatics and the imperial treachery they represented. His own Mentat assessment of the data told him how little chance he had ever to present evidence of this treachery before the High Council of the Landsrat, where justice might be done.
Do you wish to go to the smugglers?
Is it possible?
The way is long.
Fremen don't like to say no, Idaho had told him once.
You haven't yet told me whether your people can help my wounded.
They are wounded.
The same damned answer every time.
We know they're wounded. That's not the
peace, friend. What do your wounded say? Are there those among them who can see the water need of your tribe?
We haven't talked about water.
I can understand your reluctance. They are your friends, your tribesmen. Do you have water?
Not enough.
The Fremen gestured to Howard's tunic, the skin exposed beneath it.
You were caught in CH without your suits. You must make a water decision, friend.
Can we hire your help?
The Fremen shrugged.
You have no water.
He glanced at the group behind Howard.
How many of your wounded would you spend?
Howard fell silent, staring at the man. He could see as a Mentat that their communication was out of phase. Word sounds were not being linked up here in the normal manner.
I am Thufir Howard. I can speak for my Duke. I will make promissory commitment now for your help. I wish a limited form of help, preserving my force long enough only to kill a traitor who thinks herself beyond vengeance.
You wish our siding in a vendetta?
The vendetta I'll handle myself. I wish to be freed of responsibility for my wounded, that I may get about it.
The Fremen scowled.
How can you be responsible for your wounded? They are their own responsibility. The water's at issue, Thufir Howard. Would you have me take that decision away from you?
The man put a hand to a weapon concealed beneath his robe. Howard tensed, wondering, is there betrayal here?
What do you fear?
These people and their disconcerting directness. Howard spoke cautiously.
There's a price on my head.
The Fremen removed his hand from his weapon.
You think we have the Byzantine corruption? You don't know us. The Harkonnens have not water enough to buy the smallest child among us.
But they had the price of guild passage for more than 2,000 fighting ships, Howard thought. And the size of that price still staggered him.
We both fight Harkonnens. Should we not share the problems and ways of meeting the battle issue?
We are sharing. I have seen you fight Harkonnens. You are good. There have been times I'd have appreciated your arm beside me.
Say where my arm may help you.
Who knows? There are Harkonnen forces everywhere. But you still have not made the water decision or put it to your wounded.
I must be cautious, Howard told himself. There's a thing here that's not understood.
Will you show me your way? The Arakeen way?
Stranger thinking.
There was a sneer in the Fremen's tone. He pointed to the northwest, across the clifftop.
We watched you come across the sand last night. You keep your force on the slip face of the dunes. Bad. You have no still suits, no water. You will not last long.
The ways of Arrakis don't come easily.
Truth. But we've killed Harkonnens.
What do you do with your own wounded?
Does a man not know when he is worth saving? Your wounded know you have no water.
He tilted his head, looking sideways up at Howard.
This is clearly a time for water decision. Both wounded and unwounded must look to the tribe's future.
The tribe's future, Howard thought. The tribe of Atreides. There's sense in that. He forced himself to the question he had been avoiding.
Have you word of my duke or his son?
Unreadable blue eyes stared upward into Howard's.
Word?
Their fate!
Fate is the same for everyone. Your duke, it is said, has met his fate. As to the Lizan al-Ghaib, his son, that is in Liet's hands. Liet has not said.
I knew the answer without asking, Howard thought. He glanced back at his men. They were all awake now. They had heard. They were staring out across the sand, the realization in their expressions. There was no returning to Caladan for them. And now, Arrakis was lost. Howard turned back to the Fremen.
Have you heard of Duncan Idaho?
He was in the great house when the shield went down. This I've heard. No more.
She dropped the shield and let in the Harkonnens, he thought. I was the one who sat with my back to a door. How could she do this when it meant turning also against her own son? But who knows how a Bene Gesserit witch thinks, if you can call it thinking. Howard tried to swallow in a dry throat.
When will you hear about the boy?
We know little of what happens in Arrakeen. Who knows?
You have ways of finding out.
Perhaps.
The Fremen rubbed at the scar beside his nose.
Tell me, Thufir Hawat. Do you have knowledge of the big weapons the Harkonnens used?
The artillery, Hawat thought bitterly. Who could have guessed they'd use artillery in this day of shields?
You refer to the artillery they used to trap our people in the caves. I've theoretical knowledge of such explosive weapons.
Any man who retreats into a cave which has only one opening deserves to die.
Why do you ask about these weapons?
Liet wishes it.
Is that what he wants from us? Howard wondered.
Did you come here seeking information about the big guns?
Liet wished to see one of the weapons for himself.
Then you should just go take one.
Yes, we took one. We have it hidden where Stilgar can study it for Liet, and where Liet can see it for himself if he wishes. But I doubt he'll want to. The weapon is not a very good one. Poor design for Arrakis.
You took one?
It was a good fight. We lost only two men and spilled the water from more than 100 of theirs.
There was Sardaukar at every gun, Howard thought. This desert madman speaks casually of losing only two men against Sardaukar.
We would not have lost the two except for those others fighting beside the Harkonnens. Some of those are good fighters.
One of Howard's men limped forward, looking down at the squatting Fremen.
Are you talking about Sardaukar?
He's talking about Sardaukar.
Sardaukar? Ah, so that's what they are. This was a good night indeed. Sardaukar. Which legion do you know?
We don't know.
Sardaukar. Yet they wear Harkonnen clothing. Is that not strange?
The Emperor does not wish it known he fights against a great house.
But you know they are Sardaukar.
Who am I?
You are Thufir Hawat. Well, we would have learned it in time. We've sent three of them captive to be questioned by Liet's men.
You captured Sardaukar?
Only three of them. They fought well.
If only we'd had the time to link up with these Fremen, Hawat thought. It was a sour lament in his mind. If only we could have trained them and armed them. Great Mother, what a fighting force we'd have had.
Perhaps you delay because of worry over the Lizan al-Ghaib. If he is truly the Lizan al-Ghaib, harm cannot touch him. Do not spend thoughts on a matter which has not been proved.
I served Alisan al-Ghaib. His welfare is my concern. I've pledged myself to this.
You are pledged to his water?
Howard glanced at his aide, who was still staring at the Fremen, returned his attention to the squatting figure.
To his water, yes.
You wish to return to Erekin? To the place of his water?
To the place of his water.
Why did you not say at first it was a water matter?
The Fremen stood up, seated his nose plugs firmly. Howard motioned with his head for his aide to return to the others. With a tired shrug, the man obeyed. Howard heard a low-voiced conversation arise among the men.
There is always a way to water.
Behind Howard, a man cursed. Howard's aide called him.
Thufir! Arki just died.
The Fremen put a fist to his ear.
The bond of water. It's a sign.
He stared at Howard.
We have a place nearby for accepting the water. Shall I call my men?
The aide returned to Howard's side.
Thufir, a couple of the men left wives in Arakeen. They're... well, you know how it is at a time like this.
The Fremen still held his fist to his ear.
Is it the bond of water, Thufir Howard?
Howard's mind was racing. He sensed now the direction of the Fremen's words, but feared the reaction of the tired men under the rock overhang when they understood it.
The bond of water.
Let our tribes be joined.
The Fremen lowered his fist. As though that were the signal, four men slid and dropped down from the rocks above them. They darted back under the overhang, rolled the dead man in a loose robe, lifted him, and began running with him along the cliff wall to the right. Spurts of dust lifted around their running feet. It was over before Howard's tired men could gather their wits. The group, with the body hanging like a sack in its enfolding robe, was gone around a turn in the cliff.
Where are they going with Arki? He was...
They're taking him to bury him.
Fremen don't bury their dead. Don't you try any tricks on us, Thufir. We know what they do. Arki was one of...
Paradise was sure for a man who died in the service of Lisan al-Ghaib. If it is the Lisan al-Ghaib you serve, as you have said it, why raise mourning cries? The memory of one who died in this fashion will live as long as the memory of man endures.
But Howard's men advanced, angry looks on their faces. One had captured a lasgun. He started to draw it.
Stop right where you are!
Howard fought down the sick fatigue that gripped his muscles.
These people respect our dead. Customs differ, but the meaning's the same.
They're going to render Arki down for his water!
Is it that your men wish to attend the ceremony?
He doesn't even see the problem, Howard thought. The naivety of the Fremen was frightening.
They're concerned for a respected comrade.
We will treat your comrade with the same reverence we treat our own. This is the bond of water. We know the rites. A man's flesh is his own. The water belongs to the tribe.
Howard spoke quickly as the man with the lasgun advanced another step.
Will you now help our wounded?
One does not question the bond. We will do for you what a tribe does for its own. First, we must get all of you suited and see to the necessities.
The man with the lasgun hesitated. Howard's aide spoke.
Are we buying help with Arki's water?
Not buying. We've joined these people.
Customs differ.
Howard began to relax.
And they'll help us get to Arakeen?
We will kill Harkonnens and Sardaukar.
The Fremen grinned. He stepped backward, cupped his hands beside his ears, and tipped his head back, listening. Presently, he lowered his hands.
An aircraft comes. Conceal yourselves beneath the rock and remain motionless.
At a gesture from Howard, his men obeyed. The Fremen took Howard's arm, pressed him back with the others.
We will fight in the time of fighting.
He reached beneath his robes, brought out a small cage, lifted a creature from it. Howard recognized a tiny bat. The bat turned its head, and Howart saw its blue-within-blue eyes. The Fremen stroked the bat, soothing it, crooning to it. He bent over the animal's head, allowed a drop of saliva to fall from his tongue into the bat's upturned mouth. The bat stretched its wings but remained on the Fremen's opened hand. The man took a tiny tube, held it beside the bat's head, and chattered into the tube. Then, lifting the creature high, he threw it upward. The bat swooped away beside the cliff and was lost to sight. The Fremen folded the cage, thrust it beneath his robe. Again he bent his head, listening.
They quarter the high country. One wonders who they seek up there.
It's known that we retreated in this direction.
One should never presume one is the sole object of a hunt. Watch the other side of the basin. You will see a thing.
Time passed. Some of Howard's men stirred, whispering.
Remain silent as frightened animals, the Fremen hissed.
Howard discerned movement near the opposite cliff, flitting blurs of tan on tan.
My little friend carried his message, the Fremen said. He is a good messenger, day or night. I'll be unhappy to lose that one.
The movement across the sink faded away. On the entire 4 to 5 kilometer expanse of sand, nothing remained but the growing pressure of the day's heat, blurred columns of rising air.
Be most silent now,
the Fremen whispered. A file of plodding figures emerged from a break in the opposite cliff, headed directly across the sink. To Howart, they appeared to be Fremen, but a curiously inept band. He counted 6 men making heavy going of it over the dunes. A thwock-thwock of ornithopter wings sounded high to the right behind Howart's group. The craft came over the cliff wall above them. An Atreides thopter with Harkonnen battle colors splashed on it. The thopter swooped toward the men crossing the sink. The group there stopped on a dune crest, waved. The thopter circled once over them in a tight curve, came back for a dust-shrouded landing in front of the Fremen. 5 men swarmed from the thopter, and Howart saw the dust-repellent shimmering of shields, and in their motions the hard competence of Sardaukar.
Aye! They use their stupid shields!
The Fremen beside Howart hissed. He glanced toward the open south wall of the sink.
They are Sardaukar,
Howart whispered.
Good!
The Sardaukar approached the waiting group of Fremen in an enclosing half-circle. Sun glinted on blades held ready. The Fremen stood in a compact group, apparently indifferent. Abruptly, the sand around the 2 groups sprouted Fremen. They were at the ornithopter, then in it. Where the 2 groups had met at the dune crest, a dust cloud partly obscured violent motion. Presently, dust settled. Only Fremen remained standing.
They left only 3 men in their thopter, the Fremen beside Howard said. That was fortunate. I don't believe we had to damage the craft in taking it.
Behind Howard, one of his men whispered,
Those were Sardaukar. Did you notice how well they fought? The Fremen asked.
Howard took a deep breath. He smelled the burned dust around him, felt the heat, the dryness. In a voice to match that dryness, he said,
Yes, they fought well indeed.
The captured thopter took off with a lurching flap of wings, angled upward to the south in a steep, wing-tucked climb.
So these Fremen can handle thopters too, Howart thought.
On the distant dune, a Fremen waved a square of green cloth, once, twice.
More come, the Fremen beside Howart barked. Be ready. I'd hoped to have us away without more inconvenience.
Inconvenience, Howart thought. He saw 2 more thopters swooping from high in the west onto an area of sand suddenly devoid of visible Fremen. Only 8 splotches of blue, the bodies of the Sardaukar in Harkonnen uniforms, remained at the scene of violence. Another thopter glided in over the cliff wall above Howart. He drew in a sharp breath. As he saw it, a big troop carrier. It flew with the slow spread wing heaviness of a full load, like a giant bird coming to its nest. In the distance, the purple finger of a lasergun beam flicked from one of the diving thopters. It laced across the sand, raising a sharp trail of dust.
The cowards!
The Fremen beside Howart rasped. The troop carrier settled toward the patch of blue-clad bodies. Its wings crept out to full reach, began the cupping action of a quick stop. Howard's attention was caught by a flash of sun on metal to the south. A thopter plummeting there in a power dive, wings folded flat against its sides, its jets a golden flare against the dark silvered grey of the sky. It plunged like an arrow toward the troop carrier, which was unshielded because of the laser gun activity around it. Straight into the carrier, the diving thopter plunged. A flaming roar shook the basin. Rocks tumbled from the cliff walls all around. A geyser of red-orange shot skyward from the sand where the carrier and its companion thopters had been, everything there caught in the flame. It was the Fremen who took off in that captured thopter, Howard thought. He deliberately sacrificed himself to get that carrier.
Great Mother, what are these Fremen?
A reasonable exchange, said the Fremen beside Howard. There must have been 300 men in that carrier. Now, we must see to their water and make plans to get another aircraft.
He started to step out of their rock-shadowed concealment. A rain of blue uniforms came over the cliff wall in front of him, falling in low suspense of slowness. In the flashing instant, Howard had time to see that they were Saduka, hard faces set in battle frenzy, that they were unshielded and each carried a knife in one hand, a stunner in the other. A thrown knife caught Howard's Fremen companion in the throat, hurling him backward, twisting face down. Howard had only time to draw his own knife before blackness of a stunner projectile felled him.
Muad'Dib could indeed see the future, but you must understand the limits of this power. Think of sight. You have eyes, yet cannot see without light. If you are on the floor of a valley, you cannot see beyond your valley. Just so, Muad'Dib could not always choose to look across the mysterious terrain. He tells us that a single obscure decision of prophecy, perhaps the choice of one word over another, could change the entire aspect of the future. He tells us, the vision of time is broad, but when you pass through it, time becomes a narrow door. And always, he fought the temptation to choose a clear, safe course, warning, that path leads ever down into stagnation. From Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan.
As the ornithopters glided out of the night above them, Paul grabbed his mother's arm, snapped,
"Don't move!"
Then he saw the lead craft in the moonlight, the way its wings cupped to break for landing, the reckless dash of the hands at the controls.
"It's Idaho," he breathed.
The craft and its companions settled into the basin like a covey of birds coming to nest. Idaho was out of his thopter and running toward them before the dust settled. Two figures in Fremen robes followed him. Paul recognized one, the tall, sandy-bearded Kynes.
"This way!"
Kynes called, and he veered left. Behind Kynes, other Fremen were throwing fabric covers over their ornithopters. The craft became a row of shallow dunes. Idaho skidded to a stop in front of Paul, saluted.
"Milord, the Fremen have a temporary hiding place nearby where we..." "What about that, back there?"
Paul pointed to the violence above the distant cliff, the jet flares, the purple beams of laser guns lacing the desert. A rare smile touched Idaho's round, placid face.
"Milord, sire, I've left them a little sub..."
Glaring white light filled the desert, bright as a sun, etching their shadows onto the rock floor of the ledge. In one sweeping motion, Idaho had Paul's arm in one hand, Jessica's shoulder in the other, hurling them down off the ledge into the basin. They sprawled together in the sand as the roar of an explosion thundered over them. Its shock wave tumbled chips off the rock ledge they had vacated. Idaho sat up, brushed sand from himself.
"Not the family atomics," Jessica said. "I thought..." "You planted a shield back there," Paul said. "A big one, turned to full force," Idaho said. "A lasgun beam touched it and..."
He shrugged.
"Subatomic fusion," Jessica said. "That's a dangerous weapon."
"Not weapon, milady. Defense. That scum will think twice before using lasguns another time."
The Fremen from the ornithopters stopped above them.
one called in a low voice.
"We should get under cover, friends."
Paul got to his feet as Idaho helped Jessica up.
"That blast will attract considerable attention, sire," Idaho said.
Sire, Paul thought. The word had such a strange sound when directed at him. Sire had always been his father. He felt himself touched briefly by his powers of prescience, seeing himself infected by the wild race consciousness that was moving the human universe toward chaos. The vision left him shaken, and he allowed Idaho to guide him along the edge of the basin to a rock projection. Fremen there were opening a way down into the sand with their compaction tools.
"May I take your pack, sire?" Idaho asked.
"It's not heavy, Duncan," Paul said.
"You have no body shield," Idaho said. "Do you wish mine?"
He glanced at the distant cliff.
"Not likely there'll be any more lasergun activity about."
"Keep your shield, Duncan. Your right arm is shield enough for me."
Jessica saw the way the praise took effect. How Idaho moved closer to Paul, and she thought, "Such a sure hand my son has with his people." The Fremen removed a rock plug that opened a passage down into the native basement complex of the desert. A camouflage cover was rigged for the opening.
"This way,"
one of the Fremen said, and he led them down rock steps into darkness. Behind them, the cover blotted out the moonlight. A dim green glow came alive ahead, revealing the steps and rock walls, a turn to the left. Robed Fremen were all around them now, pressing downward. They rounded the corner, found another down-slanting passage. It opened into a rough cave chamber. Kynes stood before them, Jabba hood thrown back, the neck of his stillsuit glistening in the green light. His long hair and beard were mussed, the blue eyes without whites were a darkness under heavy brows. In the moment of encounter, Kynes wondered at himself. "Why am I helping these people? It's the most dangerous thing I've ever done. It could doom me with them." Then he looked squarely at Paul, seeing the boy who had taken on the mantle of manhood, masking grief, suppressing all except the position that now must be assumed, the dukedom. And Kynes realized in that moment the dukedom still existed, and solely because of this youth. And this was not a thing to be taken lightly. Jessica glanced once around the chamber, registering it on her senses in the Bene Gesserit way, a laboratory, a civil place full of angles and squares in the ancient manner.
"This is one of the Imperial ecological testing stations my father wanted as advance bases," Paul said.
His father wanted, Kynes thought, and again Kynes wondered at himself. "Am I foolish to aid these fugitives? Why am I doing it? It would be so easy to take them now, to buy the Harkonnen Trust with them." Paul followed his mother's example, gestalting the room, seeing the workbench down one side, the walls of featureless rock. Instruments lined the bench, dials glowing, wire gridex planes with fluting glass emerging from them. An ozone smell permeated the place. Some of the Fremen moved on around a concealing angle in the chamber, and new sounds started there, machine coughs, the whinnies of spinning belts and multi-drives. Paul looked to the end of the room, saw cages with small animals in them stacked against the wall.
"You've recognized this place correctly," Kynes said. "For what would you use such a place, Paul Atreides?"
"To make this planet a fit place for humans," Paul said.
"Perhaps that's why I help them," Kynes thought.
The machine sounds abruptly hummed away to silence. Into this void there came a thin animal squeak from the cages. It was cut off abruptly, as though in embarrassment. Paul returned his attention to the cages, saw that the animals were brown-winged bats. An automatic feeder extended from the side wall across the cages. A Fremen emerged from the hidden area of the chamber, spoke to Kynes.
"Liet, the field generator equipment is not working. I am unable to mask us from proximity detectors." "Can you repair it?" Kynes asked.
"Not quickly. The parts,"
The man shrugged.
Yes, Kynes said. Then we'll do without machinery. Get a hand pump for air out to the surface.
Immediately, the man hurried away. Kynes turned back to Paul.
You gave a good answer.
Jessica marked the easy rumble of the man's voice. It was a royal voice accustomed to command, and she had not missed the reference to him as Liet. Liet was the Fremen alter ego, the other face of the tame planetologist.
We are most grateful for your help, Dr. Kynes, she said.
Mm-hmm. We'll see, Kynes said.
He nodded to one of his men.
Spice coffee in my quarters, Shamir.
At once, Liet, the man said. Kynes indicated an arched opening in the side wall of the chamber.
If you please.
Jessica allowed herself a regal nod before accepting. She saw Paul give a hand signal to Idaho, telling him to mount guard here. The passage, two paces deep, opened through a heavy door into a square office lighted by golden glow globes. Jessica passed her hand across the door as she entered, was startled to identify Plasteel. Paul stepped three paces into the room, dropped his pack to the floor. He heard the door close behind him, studied the place. About 8 meters to a side, walls of natural rock, curry-coloured, broken by metal filing cabinets on their right. A low desk with milk-glass top shot full of yellow bubbles occupied the room's centre. 4 suspensor chairs ringed the desk. Kynes moved around Paul, held a chair for Jessica. She sat down, noting the way her son examined the room. Paul remained standing for another eye-blink. A faint anomaly in the room's air currents told him there was a secret exit to their right, behind the filing cabinets.
"Will you sit down, Paul Atreides?"
Kynes asked. "How carefully he avoids my title," Paul thought. But he accepted the chair, remained silent while Kynes sat down.
"You sense that Arrakis could be a paradise," Kynes said. "Yet, as you see, the Imperium sends here only its trained hatchet-men, its seekers after the spice."
Paul held up his thumb with its ducal signet. "Do you see this ring?"
"Yes."
"Do you know its significance?" Jessica turned sharply to stare at her son.
"Your father lies dead in the ruins of Arrakeen," Kynes said. "You are technically the Duke."
"I'm a soldier of the Imperium," Paul said. "Technically a hatchet man." Kynes' face darkened.
"Even with the Emperor's Sarduka standing over your father's body?"
"The Sarduka are one thing. The legal source of my authority is another," Paul said.
"Arrakis has its own way of determining who wears the mantle of authority," Kynes said.
And Jessica, turning back to look at him, thought,
"There's steel in this man that no one has taken the temper out of. And we've need of steel. Paul's doing a dangerous thing."
Paul said, "The Sarduka on Arrakis are a measure of how much our beloved Emperor feared my father. Now I will give the Padishah Emperor reasons to fear the—"
"Lad,"
Kynes said,
"there are things you don't—"
"You will address me as sire or my lord," Paul said.
Gently, Jessica thought.
Kynes stared at Paul, and Jessica noted the glint of admiration in the planetologist's face, the touch of humour there.
"Sire,"
Kynes said. "I am an embarrassment to the Emperor," Paul said. "I am an embarrassment to all who would divide Arrakis as their spoil. As I live, I shall continue to be such an embarrassment that I stick in their throats and choke them to death."
"Words,"
Kynes said. Paul stared at him. Presently, Paul said, "You have a legend of the Lisan al-Ghaib here, the voice from the outer world, the one who will lead the Fremen to paradise. Your men have—"
"Superstition,"
Kynes said. "Perhaps," Paul agreed, "yet perhaps not. Superstitions sometimes have strange roots and stranger branchings."
"You have a plan," Kynes said. "This much is obvious, sire."
"Could your Fremen provide me with proof positive that the Sarduka are here in Harkonnen uniform?"
"Quite likely.
The Emperor will put a Harkonnen back in power here, Paul said. Perhaps even Beast Raban. Let him. Once he has involved himself beyond escaping his guilt, let the Emperor face the possibility of a bill of particulars laid before the Lancerot. Let him answer there where... Paul, Jessica said. Granted that the Lancerot High Council accepts your case, Kynes said, there could be only one outcome. General warfare between the Imperium and the Great Houses. Chaos, Jessica said. But I'd present my case to the Emperor, Paul said, and give him an alternative to chaos. Jessica spoke in a dry tone. Blackmail? One of the tools of statecraft, as you've said yourself, Paul said, and Jessica heard the bitterness in his voice. The Emperor has no sons, only daughters.
You'd aim for the throne? Jessica asked.
The Emperor will not risk having the Imperium shattered by total war, Paul said. Planets blasted, disorder everywhere, he'll not risk that.
This is a desperate gamble, you propose, Kynes said.
What do the great houses of the Lancerot fear most? Paul asked. They fear most what is happening here right now on Arrakis, the Sarduka picking them off one by one. That's why there is a Lancerot. This is the glue of the Great Convention. Only in union do they match the Imperial forces.
But there...
This is what they fear, Paul said. Arrakis would become a rallying cry. Each of them would see himself in my father, cut out of the herd and killed. Kynes spoke to Jessica.
Would his plan work?
I'm no Mentat, Jessica said.
But you are Bene Gesserit.
She shot a probing stare at him, said,
His plan has good points and bad points, as any plan would at this stage. A plan depends as much upon execution as it does upon concept.
Law is the ultimate science, Paul quoted. Thus it reads above the Emperor's door. I propose to show him law.
And I'm not sure I could trust the person who conceived this plan, Kynes said. Arrakis has its own plan that we...
From the throne, Paul said. I could make a paradise of Arrakis with a wave of a hand. This is the coin I offer for your support.
Kynes stiffened.
My loyalty's not for sale, sire.
Paul stared across the desk at him, meeting the cold glare of those blue-within-blue eyes, studying the bearded face, the commanding appearance. A harsh smile touched Paul's lips, and he said, "Well spoken. I apologize." Kynes met Paul's stare, and presently said,
"No Harkonnen ever admitted error. Perhaps you're not like them, Atreides."
"It could be a fault in their education," Paul said. "You say you're not for sale, but I believe I've the coin you'll accept. For your loyalty, I offer my loyalty to you. Totally."
My son has the Atreides' sincerity, Jessica thought. He has that tremendous, almost naive honour. And what a powerful force that truly is.
She saw that Paul's words had shaken Kynes.
"This is nonsense," Kynes said. "You're just a boy, and..."
"I'm the Duke," Paul said. "I'm an Atreides. No Atreides has ever broken such a bond." Kynes swallowed. "When I say totally," Paul said, "I mean without reservation. I would give my life for you."
"Sire,"
Kynes said, and the word was torn from him. But Jessica saw that he was not now speaking to a boy of 15, but to a man, to a superior. Now Kynes meant the word. In this moment he'd give his life for Paul, she thought. How do the Atreides accomplish this thing so quickly, so easily?
"I know you mean this,"
Kynes said.
"Yet the Harkonnen..."
The door behind Paul slammed open. He whirled to see reeling violence, shouting, the clash of steel, wax image faces grimacing in the passage. With his mother beside him, Paul leaped for the door, seeing Idaho blocking the passage, his blood-pitted eyes there visible through a shield blur, claw hands beyond him, arcs of steel chopping futilely at the shield.
there was the orange fire-mouth of a stunner repelled by the shield. Idaho's blades were through it all, flick-flicking, red dripping from them. Then Kynes was beside Paul, and they threw their weight against the door. Paul had one last glimpse of Idaho standing against a swarm of Harkonnen uniforms, his jerking, controlled staggers, the black goat hair with a red blossom of death in it. Then the door was closed, and there came a snick as Kynes threw the bolts.
"I appear to have decided," Kynes said.
"Someone detected your machinery before it was shut down," Paul said. He pulled his mother away from the door, met the despair in her eyes.
"I should have suspected trouble when the coffee failed to arrive,"
Kynes said. "You've a bolt hole out of here," Paul said. "Shall we use it?" Kynes took a deep breath, said,
"This door should hold for at least 20 minutes, against all but a laser gun."
"They'll not use a laser gun for fear we've shields on this side," Paul said.
"Those were Sardaukar in Harkonnen uniform," Jessica whispered.
They could hear pounding on the door now, rhythmic blows. Kynes indicated the cabinets against the right-hand wall, said,
"This way."
He crossed to the first cabinet, opened a drawer, manipulated a handle within it. The entire wall of cabinets swung open to expose the black mouth of a tunnel.
"This door also is plasteel,"
Kynes said.
"You were well prepared," Jessica said.
"We lived under the Harkonnens for 80 years,"
Kynes said. He herded them into the darkness, closed the door. In the sudden blackness, Jessica saw a luminous arrow on the floor ahead of her. Kynes' voice came from behind them.
"We'll separate here. This wall is tougher. It'll stand for at least an hour. Follow the arrows like that one on the floor. They'll be extinguished by your passage. They lead through a maze to another exit where I've secreted a thopter. There's a storm across the desert tonight. Your only hope is to run for that storm, dive into the top of it, ride with it. My people have done this in stealing thopters. If you stay high in the storm, you'll survive."
"What of you?" Paul asked.
"I'll try to escape another way. If I'm captured, well, I'm still Imperial Planetologist. I can say I was your captive."
"Running like cowards," Paul thought. "But how else can I live to avenge my father?" He turned to face the door. Jessica heard him move, said,
"Duncan's dead, Paul. You saw the wound. You can do nothing for him."
"I'll take full payment for them all one day," Paul said.
"Not unless you hurry now," Kynes said.
Paul felt the man's hand on his shoulder. "Where will we meet, Kynes?" Paul asked.
"I'll send Fremen searching for you. The storm's path is known. Hurry now, and the Great Mother give you speed and luck."
They heard him go, a scrambling in the blackness. Jessica found Paul's hand, pulled him gently.
"We must not get separated," she said.
"Yes." He followed her across the first arrow, seeing it go black as they touched it. Another arrow beckoned ahead. They crossed it, saw it extinguish itself, saw another arrow ahead. They were running now.
"Plans within plans, within plans within plans," Jessica thought. "Have we become part of someone else's plan now?"
The arrows led them around turnings, past side openings only dimly sensed in the faint luminescence. Their way slanted downward for a time, then up, ever up. They came finally to steps, rounded a corner and were brought short by a glowing wall with a dark handle visible in its centre. Paul pressed the handle. The wall swung away from them. Light flared to reveal a rock-hewn cavern with an ornithopter squatting in its centre. A flat grey wall with a door sign on it loomed beyond the aircraft.
"Where did Kynes go?"
Jessica asked.
"He did what any good guerrilla leader would," Paul said. "He separated us into two parties and arranged that he couldn't reveal where we are if he's captured. He won't really know."
Paul drew her into the room, noting how their feet kicked up dust on the floor.
"No one's been here for a long time," he said.
"He seemed confident the Fremen could find us," she said.
"I share that confidence."
Paul released her hand, crossed to the ornithopter's left door, opened it and secured his pack in the rear. "This ship's proximity masked," he said. Instrument panel has remote door control, light control. 80 years under the Harkonnens taught them to be thorough. Jessica leaned against the craft's other side, catching her breath.
The Harkonnens will have a covering force over this area, she said. They're not stupid.
She considered her direction sense, pointed right.
The storm we saw is that way.
Paul nodded, fighting an abrupt reluctance to move. He knew its cause, but found no help in the knowledge. Somewhere this night he had passed a decision nexus into the deep unknown. He knew the time area surrounding them, but the here and now existed as a place of mystery. It was as though he had seen himself from a distance go out of sight down into a valley. Of the countless paths up out of that valley, some might carry a Paul Atreides back into sight, but many would not.
The longer we wait, the better prepared they'll be, Jessica said.
Get in and strap yourself down, he said. He joined her in the ornithopter, still wrestling with the thought that this was blind ground, unseen in any prescient vision. And he realized with an abrupt sense of shock that he had been giving more and more reliance to prescient memory, and it had weakened him for this particular emergency. If you rely only on your eyes, your other senses weaken. It was a Bene Gesserit axiom. He took it to himself now, promising never again to fall into that trap. If he lived through this. Paul fastened his safety harness, saw that his mother was secure, checked the aircraft. The wings were at full spread rest, their delicate metal interleavings extended. He touched the retractor bar, watched the wings shorten for jet boost takeoff, the way Gurney Halleck had taught him. The starter switch moved easily. Dials on the instrument panel came alive as the jet pods were armed. Turbines began their low hissing. Ready? He asked.
Yes.
He touched the remote control for lights. Darkness blanketed them. His hand was a shadow against the luminous dials as he tripped the remote door control. Grating sounded ahead of them. A cascade of sand swished away to silence. A dusty breeze touched Paul's cheeks. He closed his door, feeling the sudden pressure. A wide patch of dust-blurred stars framed in angular darkness appeared where the door wall had been. Starlight defined a shelf beyond, a suggestion of sand ripples. Paul depressed the glowing action sequence switch on his panel. The wings snapped back and down, hurling the thopter out of its nest. Power surged from the jet pods as the wings locked into lift attitude. Jessica let her hands ride lightly on the dual controls, feeling the sureness of her son's movements. She was frightened, yet exhilarated. Now, Paul's training is our only hope, she thought. His youth and swiftness. Paul fed more power to the jet pods. The thopter banked, sinking them into their seats as a dark wall lifted against the stars ahead. He gave the craft more wing, more power. Another burst of lifting wing beats, and they came out over rocks, silver-frosted angles and outcroppings in the starlight. The dust-reddened second moon showed itself above the horizon to their right, defining the ribbon trail of the storm. Paul's hands danced over the controls. Wings snicked into beetle stubs. G-force pulled at their flesh as the craft came around in a tight bank.
Jet flares behind us, Jessica said.
I saw them. He slammed the power arm forward. Their thopter leaped like a frightened animal, surged southwest toward the storm and the great curve of desert. In the near distance, Paul saw scattered shadows telling where the line of rocks ended, the basement complex sinking beneath the dunes. Beyond stretched moonlit fingernail shadows, dunes diminishing one into another. And above the horizon climbed the flat immensity of the storm like a wall against the stars. Something jarred the thopter.
Shellburst! Jessica gasped. They're using some kind of projectile weapon.
She saw a sudden animal grin on Paul's face.
They seem to be avoiding their lasguns, he said. But we've no shields. Do they know that?
Again the Thopter shuddered. Paul twisted to peer back. Only one of them appears to be fast enough to keep up with us.
He returned his attention to their course, watching the storm wall grow high in front of them. It loomed like a tangible solid.
Projectile launchers, rockets, all the ancient weaponry. That's one thing we'll give the Fremen, Paul whispered.
The storm, Jessica said. Hadn't you better turn?
What about the ship behind us?
He's pulling up.
Now.
Paul stubbed the wings, banked hard left into the deceptively slow boiling of the storm wall, felt his cheeks pull in the G-force. They appeared to glide into a slow clouding of dust that grew heavier and heavier until it blotted out the desert and the moon. The aircraft became a long, horizontal whisper of darkness, lighted only by the green luminosity of the instrument panel. Through Jessica's mind flashed all the warnings about such storms, that they cut metal like butter, etched flesh to bone and ate away the bones. She felt the buffeting of dust-blanketed wind. It twisted them as Paul fought the controls. She saw him chop the power, felt the ship buck. The metal around them hissed and trembled.
Sand! Jessica shouted.
She saw the negative shake of his head in the light from the panel.
Not much sand this high.
But she could feel them sinking deeper into the maelstrom. Paul sent the wings to their full, soaring length, heard them creak with the strain. He kept his eyes fixed on the instruments, gliding by instinct, fighting for altitude. The sound of their passage diminished. The Thopter began rolling off to the left. Paul focused on the glowing globe within the attitude curve, fought his craft back to level flight. Jessica had the eerie feeling that they were standing still, that all motion was external. A vague tan flowing against the windows, a rumbling hiss reminded her of the powers around them.
Winds to 700 or 800 kilometers an hour, she thought.
Adrenaline edginess gnawed at her.
I must not fear,
she told herself, mouthing the words of the Bene Gesserit litany.
Fear is the mind killer.
Slowly her long years of training prevailed. Calmness returned.
We have the tiger by the tail, Paul whispered. We can't go down, can't land. And I don't think I can lift us out of this. We'll have to ride it out.
Calmness drained out of her. Jessica felt her teeth chattering, clamped them together. Then she heard Paul's voice, low and controlled, reciting the litany.
Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past me, I will turn to see fear's path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain.
What do you despise? By this you are truly known. From Manual of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
They're dead, Baron. Both the woman and the boy are certainly dead.
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen sat up in the sleep suspensers of his private quarters. Beyond these quarters, and enclosing him like a multi-shelled egg, stretched the space frigate he had grounded on Arrakis. Here in his quarters, though, the ship's harsh metal was disguised with draperies, with fabric paddings and rare art objects.
It is a certainty. They are dead.
The Baron shifted his gross body in the suspensors, focused his attention on an ebony statue of a leaping boy in a niche across the room. Sleep faded from him. He straightened the padded suspensor beneath the fat folds of his neck, stared across the single glow globe of his bedchamber to the doorway where Captain Nefhud stood blocked by the pentashield.
They're certainly dead, Baron.
The Baron noted the trace of Semuta dullness in Nefhud's eyes. It was obvious the man had been deep within the drug's rapture when he received this report, and had stopped only to take the antidote before rushing here.
I have a full report.
Let him sweat a little, the Baron thought.
One must always keep the tools of statecraft sharp and ready. Power and fear, sharp and ready.
Have you seen their bodies? Well?
My lord, they were seen to dive into a sandstorm. Winds over 800 kilometers. Nothing survives such a storm, my lord. Nothing. One of our own craft was destroyed in the pursuit.
The Baron stared at Nefud, noting the nervous twitch in the scissors line of the man's jaw muscles, the way the chin moved as Nefud swallowed.
You have seen the bodies?
My lord.
For what purpose do you come here rattling your armor? To tell me a thing is certain when it is not? Do you think I'll praise you for such stupidity, give you another promotion?
Nefud's face went bone pale. Look at that chicken, the Baron thought. I'm surrounded by such useless clods. If I scattered sand before this creature and told him it was grain, he'd peck at it.
The man Idaho led us to them, then?
Yes, my lord.
Look how he blurts out his answer, the Baron thought.
They were attempting to flee to the Fremen, eh?
Yes, my lord.
Is there more to this report?
The Imperial Planetologist, Kynes, is involved, my lord. Idaho joined this Kynes under mysterious circumstances. I might even say, suspicious circumstances.
So?
They fled together to a place in the desert where it's apparent the boy and his mother were hiding. In the excitement of the chase, several of our groups were caught in a laser gun shield explosion.
How many did we lose?
I'm not sure yet, my lord.
He's lying, the Baron thought. It must have been pretty bad.
The Imperial lackey, this Kynes. He was playing a double game, huh?
I'd stake my reputation on it, my lord.
His reputation, the Baron thought.
Have the man killed.
My lord, Kynes is the Imperial Planetologist, His Majesty's own servant.
Make it look like an accident, then.
My lord, there were Saudakar with our forces in the subjugation of this Fremen nest. They have Kynes in custody now.
Get him away from them. Say I wish to question him.
If they demur?
They will not if you handle it correctly.
Yes, my lord.
The man must die. He tried to help my enemies.
Nefud shifted from one foot to the other.
Well?
My lord, the Saudakar have two persons in custody who might be of interest to you. They've got the Duke's Master of Assassins.
Hawat? Thufir Hawat?
I've seen the captive myself, my lord. 'Tis Hawat.
I'd not have believed it possible.
They say he was knocked out by a stunner, my lord. In the desert where he couldn't use his shield, he's virtually unharmed. If we can get our hands on him, he'll provide great sport.
This is a Mentat you speak of. One doesn't waste a Mentat. Has he spoken? What does he say of his defeat? Could he know the extent of... But no.
He's spoken only enough, my lord, to reveal his belief that the Lady Jessica was his betrayer.
You're sure it's the Lady Jessica who attracts his anger?
He said it in my presence, my lord.
Let him think she's alive, then.
But my lord...
Be quiet. I wish Howard treated kindly. He must be told nothing of the late Dr. Yui, his true betrayer. Let it be said that Dr. Yui died defending his duke. In a way, this may even be true. We will instead feed his suspicions against the Lady Jessica.
My lord, I don't...
The way to control and direct a Mentat, Nefud, is through his information. False information, false results.
Yes, my lord, but...
Is Howat hungry? Thirsty?
My lord, Howat's still in the hands of the Saudakar.
Yes, indeed, yes. But the Saudakar will be as anxious to get information from Howat as I am. I've noticed a thing about our allies, Nefud. They're not very devious, politically. I do believe this is a deliberate thing. The Emperor wants it that way. Yes, I do believe it. You will remind the Saudakar commander of my renown at obtaining information from reluctant subjects.
Yes, my lord.
You will tell the Saudakar commander that I wish to question both Hawat and this Kynes at the same time, playing one off against the other. He can understand that much, I think.
Yes, my lord.
And once we have them in our hands...
My lord, the Saudakar will want an observer with you during any questioning.
I'm sure we can produce an emergency to draw off any unwanted observers, Nefud.
I understand, my lord. That's when Kynes can have his accident.
Both Kynes and Hawat will have accidents then, Nafud. But only Kynes will have a real accident. It's Hawat I want. Yes. Ah, yes.
Nafud blinked, swallowed. He appeared about to ask a question, but remained silent.
Hawat will be given both food and drink, treated with kindness, with sympathy. In his water, you will administer the residual poison developed by the late Peter de Vries, and you will see that the antidote becomes a regular part of Hawat's diet from this point on, unless I say otherwise.
The antidote, yes, but...
Don't be dense, Nafud. The Duke almost killed me with that poison capsule tooth. The gas he exhaled into my presence deprived me of my most valuable mentat. Peter, I need a replacement.
Hawat?
Hawat.
But...
You're going to say Hawat's completely loyal to the Atreides. True, but the Atreides are dead. We will woo him. He must be convinced he's not to blame for the Duke's demise. It was all the doing of that Bene Gesserit witch. He had an inferior master, one whose reason was clouded by emotion. Mentats admire the ability to calculate without emotion, Nafud. We will woo the formidable Thufir Hawat.
Woo him? Yes, my lord.
Hawat unfortunately had a master whose resources were poor, one who could not elevate a mentat to the sublime peaks of reasoning that are a mentat's right. Hawat will see a certain element of truth in this. The Duke couldn't afford the most efficient spies to provide his mentat with the required information. Let us never deceive ourselves, Nafud. The truth is a powerful weapon. We know how we overwhelmed the Atreides. Hawat knows, too. We did it with wealth.
With wealth? Yes, my lord.
We will woo Hawat. We will hide him from the Sardaukar. And we will hold in reserve the withdrawal of the antidote for the poison. There's no way of removing the residual poison. And Nafud, Hawat need never suspect. The antidote will not betray itself to a poison snooper. Hawat can scan his food as he pleases and detect no trace of poison.
Nafud's eyes opened wide with understanding.
The absence of a thing, this can be as deadly as the presence. The absence of air, the absence of water, the absence of anything else we're addicted to. You understand me, Nafud?
Yes, my lord.
Then get busy. Find the Sardaukar commander and set things in motion.
At once, my lord.
Nafud bowed, turned, and hurried away.
Hawat by my side, the Baron thought. The Sardaukar will give him to me. If they suspect anything at all, it's that I wish to destroy the Mentat. And this suspicion I'll confirm, the fools. One of the most formidable mentats in all history. A mentat trained to kill, and they'll toss him to me like some silly toy to be broken. I will show them what use can be made of such a toy.
The Baron reached beneath a drapery beside his suspenser bed, pressed a button to summon his older nephew, Rabban. He sat back, smiling.
And all the Atreides dead.
The stupid guard captain had been right, of course. Certainly nothing survived in the path of a sandblast storm on Arrakis. Not an ornithopter or its occupants. The woman and the boy were dead. The bribes in the right places, the unthinkable expenditure to bring overwhelming military force down onto one planet, all the sly reports tailored for the Emperor's ears alone, all the careful scheming, were here at last coming to full fruition. Power and fear. Fear and power. The Baron could see the path ahead of him. One day, a Harkonnen would be emperor. Not himself, and no spawn of his loins, but a Harkonnen. Not this Rabban he'd summoned, of course, but Rabban's younger brother, young Fade Rautha. There was a sharpness to the boy that the Baron enjoyed, a ferocity. A lovely boy, the Baron thought. A year or two more, say, by the time he's 17, I'll know for certain whether he's the tool that House Harkonnen requires to gain the throne.
My lord Baron.
The man who stood outside the doorfield of the Baron's bedchamber was low-built, gross of face and body,
with the Harkonnen paternal line's narrow-set eyes and bulge of shoulders. There was yet some rigidity in his fat, but it was obvious to the eye that he'd come one day to the portable suspensors for carrying his excess weight.
A muscle-minded tank brain, the Baron thought. No Mentet, my nephew. Not a Peiter de Vries.
But perhaps something more precisely devised for the task at hand. If I give him freedom to do it, he'll grind over everything in his path. Oh, how he'll be hated here on Arrakis.
My dear Raban.
The Baron released the Dorfield, but pointedly kept his body shield at full strength, knowing that the shimmer of it would be visible above the bedside glow-globe.
You summoned me?
Raban stepped into the room, flicked a glance past the air disturbance of the body shield, searched for a suspensor chair, found none.
Stand closer where I can see you easily.
Raban advanced another step, thinking that the damnable old man had deliberately removed all chairs, forcing a visitor to stand.
The Atreides are dead, the last of them. That's why I summoned you here to Arrakis. This planet is again yours.
But I thought you were going to advance Peiter de Vries to the...
Peiter, too, is dead.
Peiter?
Peiter.
The Baron reactivated the Dorfield, blanked it against all energy penetration.
You finally tired of him, eh?
I will say a thing to you just this once. You insinuate that I obliterated Peiter as one obliterates a trifle. Just like that, huh? I'm not so stupid, nephew. I will take it unkindly if ever again you suggest by word or action that I am so stupid.